Andrew Sill is the Associate Music Director of the New York City Ballet. He joined New York City Ballet in the spring of 2009 and served as Interim Music Director from 2012 to 2015. He also serves as Music Director of Milwaukee Ballet.
Andrews was just 15 years old when he was accepted as a conducting and piano student at Yale University, where he received his bachelor's degree with honors. He continued his education under scholarship and fellowship awards from the Manhattan School of Music, earning his doctorate in 1987.
He will be conducting A Midsummer Night's Dream and the gala program of contemporary works on Saturday night. Andrew Sill, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So how many years have you been coming here to Saratoga?
I believe this is my 10th summer. I started as a guest conductor here and did a few summers as a guest and then have been coming ever since. And I cannot begin to tell you how much I love coming up here.
Well, are you still doing guest gigs?
I do a few guest gigs, yes. The New York City Ballet takes a lot of my time, but I like to get out there and sort of have as big a perspective on things as possible. So
what's the big difference between, Saratoga and Milwaukee?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Saratoga, I'm an East Coast boy, so to me, this feels really comfortable. I adore being able to be outdoors, but also be in an environment that feels like a theater. You have the best of both worlds here. You have the outdoors that surrounds you, but you also have a theater with all of the facilities to make a great performance happen. And how does it compare to Milwaukee? Well, I love the Midwest because I lived there for almost 20 years.
Right.
But it has a very different character. I feel like when I go from the East Coast to the Midwest, I'm definitely in a different environment out there.
You live in the best place in the world, on the west side of Manhattan. So my question is, has that affected your character?
Well, I'm a New Yorker born and bred. I was born at New York Hospital. And so I can't answer that question because I have absolutely no perspective on that. Of course, I would have to say that, yes, it affects my character in only the most positive way.
What happens, and I'll let Joe go, but what happens when you hear, the French horn, which is the most difficult instrument in the orchestra, hit a clinker? Do you look at them? Do you glare at them? How do you do that?
Well, you just said it. It's the most difficult instrument in the world, and you have an incredible amount of sympathy and empathy for the people who are trying to make beautiful music. And once in a while, yes, they are human. So, to me, that's part of a live performance. If everything just sounded like a perfect recording, it would be a little bit sterile after a while.
Yeah.
So, I don't give them a glare. I kind of smile inwardly, and I think, boy, you just proved that you're human. Good for you.
I would just love it if you had been my conductor.
So speaking of conducting and being a conductor, are there ingredients that are different in being a conductor for a ballet orchestra versus an orchestra?
Yeah, the biggest ingredient I think that's different, obviously, is that you have a whole stage full of people who are putting on either a story or who are creating an atmosphere on the stage. And so you have to be sensitive to the fact, as one of my teachers used to put it, who conducted for ballet, he said, you have to be unusually sensitive to gravity, by which he meant that, if a dancer goes up in the air, at some point he or she is going to come down. And so you're thinking about the pacing all of the time. You're thinking about the pacing that's going to make them look as good as possible.
But you can't pace if the guy's up in the air and he's coming down, you can't go, like Danny Kaye used to go, slow.
You have to find a way to anticipate that, I think. And
really?
And the more you do it, I mean, I would love to say that I've gotten great at it over the years, but it really still is a big challenge to be able to watch an incredible dancer like Sarah Mearns or Jared Engel or whoever it is, and you get a sense of when they're going to take off in the air. You have to have a sense of musically, when are they going to come back down?
But you can't change the music while they're doing it, can you?
You can't change it while it's happening, so you have to have that sense of anticipation.
That's so interesting.
And God forbid if something, and it's the New York City Ballet, so nothing, this doesn't happen, but if something goes wrong, then and they either they don't come down, or when they come down, they don't come down as gracefully as you thought they were going to. Is that on you then to kind of cover that, to give them a moment to get back into it?
I think probably the best answer to that is what they would want is they also want a sense of being able to anticipate what the music is going to do. So it really is kind of a symbiotic relationship there, which is to say that if you're always trying to adjust the music back and forth to them, then they never get a sense of pacing. So the answer to your question, I think, is yes. You do keep going, and you try and make the music sound as natural as possible so that if on those rare occasions when they don't do it the way they want to, they still know exactly where the music is going, and they mm-hmm. can put themselves back into
right
it.
Right back into it. Yeah.
So James Levine has been on this program a number of times when we've been here, and the question is whether or not it's harder to conduct for opera or for dance.
Well, I'm going to say it's a little bit harder for dance for one simple reason. I think the challenges for both are very similar in a way.
Really?
But opera singers speak my language, so that if I'm talking to an opera singer, we're both speaking a musical language, and we can quickly come to an agreement about what might need to be adjusted or how things should be. With a dancer, a conductor has to learn enough of a dancer's language and vice versa, so that when we're talking to each other and we're trying to figure out what they need and what the music can or can't do for them, the language is a little more complicated, I think. It's not quite as easy and as quick. There's no shorthand.
So we saw Joshua Bell the other night. Mm-hmm. How important, when you're doing your work, do soloists become?
Well, for New York City Ballet, we have an unbelievable repertory of pieces that have soloists, either piano soloists or violin soloists or other soloists. As a matter of fact, in the second week of our season here, we're going to do the Barber Violin Concerto. And that introduces a really interesting other dimension, because if you're doing a symphony concert, what you want to do is find a way that you and the soloist are completely on the same page as far as the interpretation. But now you have the Barber Violin Concerto where you're doing that, but you also have all these people on stage and they have to move in a particular way. And so it's like a multi-dimensional puzzle to put together. Kurt Nickanen, who's playing the Barber Violin Concerto next week, Kurt and I just did the Barber Violin Concerto in Paris with the company, and it was fascinating to do it with a new orchestra and put all those pieces of the puzzle again together. That adds a very interesting other dimension.
When it comes to the repertoire, how much of that is set to say it's the New York City Ballet repertoire? And obviously, I would assume, you can always bring things in and bring things out of that.
That's true. What's interesting about our repertoire is that there are a lot of pieces that we play that do not ordinarily show up on symphony concerts. So, in other words, the crossover between what the Boston Symphony might play on a concert or what we might play is not always as large as you would expect. A good example of that, I can say, would be going on tonight with Stravinsky's Agon, which is a fabulous piece of music and a fabulous ballet, but symphony orchestras just typically don't put that on a program. It's a little bit thorny. It is so married to the movement that Stravinsky saw in his head and that Balanchine was discussing with him as he was writing it that symphonies don't tend to touch that. So that's what's interesting about our repertoire is that there are pieces like that where they're unique to us in a way.
I was at a concert where they had, in the program guide, they had Stravinsky's picture. Do you ever look at those pictures and say, here I am conducting this guy's music. What was he like?
Well, of course, you know, I've studied Stravinsky for years. He happens to be one of my favorite composers. I will tell you, the answer to your question is yes, but when it really struck me, I was doing a little introduction for the audience at the David H. Koch Theater one night of a Stravinsky piece, and I had decided that I was going to use a snippet of a radio interview that Stravinsky had done on WQXR. And so we put this little snippet onto the loudspeaker, and it went out into the hall. And suddenly I'm standing there and I'm hearing Stravinsky's voice in the theater, where, you know, he's basically the house composer, because his relationship with Balanchine was so close. And then that was one of those goosebump moments where I thought, oh my God, I'm here in this theater, Stravinsky's talking to us, and I'm about to conduct his music. And that, that was, yes, that was definitely a one of those moments that I will not forget.
He was wearing one of those collars. You know, the collars that the old guys used to wear with him. Forget it. I never asked.
He was a priest? What?
No, it wasn't. It was one of those collars.
Not one of those collars.
One of those collars that those guys wore. Yeah.
When it comes to the, again, looking at the repertoire, I was struck by something you said a moment ago about of what, because obviously Balanchine had something, what he had in his mind and in his head of what he wanted to be on that stage. But obviously you have to have something in your mind and in your head of what you're going to see on that stage. Do those always have to equal each other?
I think ideally you would want them to. But of course I'm not arrogant enough to say that I would know what that I would always have in my head exactly what Balanchine had in his head when he was when he was choreographing. So I think what you do is, after years of watching, you kind of have a sense of the parameters of what Balanchine created. Because every night, you know, I can't stand up on the podium and do exactly the same speed in exactly the same place, and nor do I think would anybody want me to. But on the other hand, you have parameters for how the energy of that moment in the music would translate into a movement that you do see in your head. And maybe it varies a little bit from night to night, but it's there.
So here's a better question, in that you are going to be conducting the Justin Peck piece.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
So he's here. And, and so what kind of conversations do the two of you have so that vision winds up?
It's interesting. It's a conversation that, of course, involves what speed certain things should be in order to accommodate movement. But it's also a question of pacing, so that the visual effects that he wants to create can happen. At the same time, he's having a conversation with me because he's saying, well, but musically, is this going to make the music sound odd if we do it this way? And generally I'll say no, or I'll say, well, it won't sound odd if we could just tweak this here. And so we're balancing our ideas of what the parameters of the music are with what the parameters of his vision, his visual idea is.
Your wife is a viola player, so my question to you is, does that in some way lead you towards the strings when you're conducting versus the horns? Or?
It doesn't necessarily lead me there, but she has given me a tremendous amount of helpful information over the years. And because I am not a string player, I'm a pianist. And so having her as a tutor in that way is incredibly helpful. I mean, the strings are obviously the largest section in the orchestra, and so to have somebody who says to me, well, you know, what sound do you want there? And I sing something, or I awkwardly try and tell her, and she said, okay, well, we're going to translate that into how a string player would talk. Huh. So, yes, it's very, very helpful.
Wow. So you can go home tonight?
Yes, but I will tell you that she's also a tough critic. She doesn't let me get away with anything. So if I'm up there conducting and
I think Joe and I understand this.
Yes. I can tell you
we need our tough critics.
Last night I conducted Midsummer Night's Dream, and the orchestra played beautifully. But, you know, she said, well, perhaps you could have done this a little differently and that a little different. So, I mean, she's incredibly supportive, but I love that kind of help, because conductors don't typically get it. You know, conductors generally, everybody says, oh, you're wonderful.
Sure.
Because, of course, you're the guy with the baton.
Right.
And so to have somebody say, well, you were wonderful, but you might have tried this a little differently. That's actually very helpful.
Well, we have to wrap up, but we think you're wonderful.
We do.
I appreciate that so much.
Andrew Sill will be conducting A Midsummer Night's Dream in the Gala Program of Contemporary Works on Saturday night. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great
to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.